It seems fair and apt to refer to cancer as one of the most serious health epidemics of our time, at least here in the advanced capitalist countries of the West. It is a disease that has reached such mass proportions that one would be hard-pressed to find anyone who has not known someone or themselves been afflicted with the disease. One in every 2.4 Canadian males will develop cancer in their lifetime, and one in every 3.6 will die from it. One in every 2.7 Canadian females will develop cancer, and 23% of the female population will die from it. It is the number one killer of children in the U.S. after accidents. Has it always been this way? When we talk about cancer as an epidemic, we acknowledge it as a brutal and often fatal disease of mass proportions, but we can and perhaps should also talk about it as a disease whose ubiquity has really only developed over the course of the last century, and a disease that has accelerated at an alarming rate, especially over the past 50 years. From 1950 to 1998 in the U.S., the overall incidence of cancer rose about 60%. From 1970 to 1998, even after controlling for aging, the incidence of cancer in Canada increased by 35% for men and 27% for women. How do we account for this rapid acceleration? And are some of us more unequally at risk than others? While mainstream medicine and the multi-billion dollar cancer establishment fixates on damage control, diagnosis, and basic genetic research, industry and corporations continue to contaminate our food, air, water, land, and consumer products with carcinogens, and then obstruct any efforts to regulate the use of toxins in production processes. Most research shows that between 80 to 90% of human cancer is determined environmentally, and is therefore, at least theoretically, avoidable through prevention. Yet still we're fed the dominant narrative of cancer as a disease we are either genetically predisposed to or bear individual responsibility for as a matter of lifestyle choice. It is a narrative that not only encourages complacency and fatalism, but it is one that takes the capitalist system of production and distribution as efficient and given, with only occasional limp acknowledgement of its disease-generating effects. Welcome to The Growth Principle, a radio documentary exploring the relationship between cancer, capitalism, and class in the industrialized West, produced here at CKUT Radio in Montreal. Over the next 45 minutes, we will hear from Kathy Walker, the National Health and Safety Director of the CAW, the Canadian Auto Workers Union, which is the biggest private sector union in Canada. She has been involved in the CAW's National Prevent Cancer Campaign. We will also be hearing from Dr. Jim Brophy, the Executive Director for the Occupational Health Clinic for Ontario Workers in Sarnia. We will be talking about the relationship the advent of pandemic cancer has to the advancement of capitalism, and the profit motive underscoring the mass use of carcinogens in production processes, about the disproportionate share of the cancer burden blue-collar workers are bearing, about the class bias of the cancer establishment and its interest in maintaining a status quo that includes hostility to effective cancer prevention, and the role of labor and other community sectors in challenging the capitalist production of this disease.
Cancer is a disease that affects so many people. Usually when we give educational presentations, and we've had conferences on cancer all across the country to try and alert people to this problem, we usually begin by asking people how many people in the room have either been affected by cancer themselves or a family member or a neighbor or a coworker. And almost everybody in the room puts up their hands. I mean, it's very, very rare for someone not to have been personally touched by this terrible disease. So that usually means that there's a lot of interest in the room, and a lot of interest, obviously, in Canadian society about this disease, and a real keen interest in doing something about it.
I'm wondering how we have come to speak about it as a disease that is occurring at the level of epidemic proportions. And I'm wondering if you, from an occupational perspective, can talk a little bit about how it has evolved in the industrialized world over the past century or so.
Well, I think we've really seen a dramatic escalation in cancer as a result of the Industrial Revolution beginning, certainly when we look at the kinds of cancers that are caused by burning of coal, burning of fossil fuel, we've certainly seen a rise, and that certainly is directly as a result of the Industrial Revolution. And then we've also seen an even more dramatic rise, particularly since the Second World War. First World War certainly contributed, but since the Second World War, we've introduced so many new chemicals that never existed before into our environment, into our workplaces. And, you know, the human body has evolved over, you know, millions of years. You can't expect any organism, human or animal or plant, to develop defenses to these brand new chemicals that, you know, we've never seen before. So we shouldn't really be surprised, given we're engaging in this terrible experiment throughout our whole planet, we shouldn't be surprised to see the number of people and plants and animals that are developing cancer as a result of all these new chemicals that nobody bothered to study properly before we simply unleashed them.
What we discovered both at homes and among the building trades workers here that worked as the skilled trades force in the petrochemical industry, you know, certainly since the 1950s on, and at the Owens Corning plant, was this pattern of elevated disease, particularly of diseases like cancer and respiratory disease. And one of the major problems, of course, is that the incidence of cancer in this country and in industrialized countries across the globe has been rising pretty steadily, you know, certainly since the 1970s. And we know that we've been producing, you know, a tremendous array of synthetic chemicals. About 85,000 are in common use now, and very few of them have been tested for their effects on human health, or on animal health for that matter. And so we have this incidence of disease increasing. We have the mass introduction of synthetic chemicals and toxic substances into the work environment and into the general environment. But nobody is documenting the occupational histories of cancer patients. And so unless you stumble into communities, industrial blue-collar communities like Sarnia, or for a variety of factors, the workers have an epidemiological study, a health-based study, like the Owens Corning workers did as an example, you just don't know what the real impact of work and cancer and diseases like that are. And that is one of the major issues that I think these stories bring out. From my point of view, is if we were to actually document the occupational histories of cancer patients in this country, we would find that work is playing a very serious contributing role to this disease, and that if there was the political will, we could intervene and reduce the cancer burden not only for these individuals but for society as a whole by simply eliminating these exposures and reducing these exposures.
You've also completed a PhD that has involved intensive research on breast cancer. Can you tell us a little bit about what kinds of discoveries you've made, and perhaps talk a little bit about how your approach to cancer research itself is differentiated from some of the standard work that's being done exploring cancer causation and therefore cancer prevention?
The major differential between the work we're doing and what I think is generally being done in cancer research, which focuses, you know, primarily around treatment and pharmaceutical agents and chemotherapy and so on, is that we actually are asking and looking at occupation as a potential risk factor. I mean, right through the 20th century, industrial workers were the major group that identified carcinogens, human carcinogens, for the whole of society. Of the 22 substances, for instance, that we know cause lung cancer in the human population, 21, the 22nd being tobacco smoke, but the other 21 were all determined by looking at the excess mortality of industrial workers that were exposed to these substances. That's how we knew that for instance, that asbestos caused cancer. We knew it because of the excess deaths of workers. In spite of the fact of the central role that workers played in the identification of carcinogens and the real identification of their impact on human health, very little was done to document in a broad way their histories that could have identified other substances and other exposures and other work processes that might be contributing, among other groups of workers, these types of diseases. In fact, in the United States, there was something like in the area of $30 million set aside for state cancer registries to begin to collect the occupational histories of cancer patients, and not one state cancer registry would use this money that was specifically designated for this to undertake that task. There was so little will among the cancer establishment to look at these issues that you have to ask some very, kind of fundamental questions about how, as a society, how important it is to really prevent these diseases if they're occurring among people that have, are not at the highest social economic classes, have little political power and voice. What began in Windsor was that Windsor, being an auto community and having, identified in lots of different studies and by their own district health council and so on, elevated cancer rates compared to the rest of the province of Ontario, and having a very active trade union movement that had a long history of involvement in occupational health, in the mid-1990s, for the first time, really, and one of the first times in Canada, a local cancer center began to collect occupational histories. And in 1999, we examined the data we had, and what we found, which we never anticipated, was elevated risk of breast cancer among women who had ever farmed, who were 55 years of age or younger. Well, this was a very, for us, a very surprising finding. And the reason for that, as we started examining the issue, and the reason we began to see its significance was that, first of all, breast cancer is the most prevalent, most common cancer among women in industrial countries and in Canada and in Ontario. It's been increasing pretty steadily for the last 25 years. It's now affecting almost 1 in 8 women in Canada. Sometime in their lifetime will develop breast cancer. But of real significance is that the majority of cases cannot be explained by what we either now know or suspect are the traditional risk factors for breast cancer. So the majority of women who are getting this disease, we don't understand why it is that they have it. Their mothers and grandmothers didn't have breast cancer. They had lots of children. They didn't take necessarily oral contraceptives. They breastfed their kids. These are all risk factors associated with estrogen, what we call estrogen load, because estrogen, the hormone, seems to be highly implicated in breast cancer. And so you would imagine that there would be a tremendous outcry to look at this disease, which is having the most profound effect on women, and has certainly been identified by the women's health movement as a major issue for them, and yet no one was collecting the occupational histories of breast cancer.
It's the objective of capitalism to maximize profits by minimizing costs, labor costs, material expenses, taxes, environmental costs. In the 19th century, low costs were guaranteed by the rampant exploitation of workers, including prolonged working days, slave wages, and the use of child labor. When workers mobilized on a mass level in the capitalist West in the 1930s and the 40s, they demanded higher wages, shorter working days, and better working conditions in the factories and the mines. The development of productivity, set against this context of new limitation on the capacity of capitalist industry to exploit its workers, necessitated finding other means of lowering costs through ever more advanced technological and management techniques. They did so by mechanization, which in the 20th century became the primary means by which an increase in productivity was enabled. Mechanization has tended to generate a more energy and chemical intensive production process, which in turn has resulted in significant transformation in the quality of our air, water, food, and home and work environments. To put it bluntly, it has meant pumping carcinogens into our environment and into the processes used to make almost everything human beings consume. It has also meant discrediting and disempowering those who challenge the capacity of capitalists to do so. And those who have the most at stake are already the most disempowered in society. When we consider the complete life cycle of carcinogens, from manufacture through use to disposal, scientific study shows that low-income earners and their families are the most likely to be exposed. It is blue-collar workers who bear the brunt of occupational exposures caused by carcinogens used in industrial production processes. When it comes to carcinogen-laden foods, economic disparity means that some individuals have more choice in the matter than others. And it is the people with lower incomes, themselves often people of color and immigrants, living in poorer neighborhoods, who are closest to the contaminants dumped into our soil and water supplies. Challenging the production of cancer in the name of economic efficiency is both an economic and political process, often carried out at the level of the state, the workplace, and the community. It is a task primarily left to community groups, environmentalists, public health workers, independent scientists, academics, and labor.
I recently read a report put out by the Canadian Centre for Policy Alternatives called Cancer as a Social Epidemic, and it correlated the increase in incidences of cancer with changes in the capitalist modes of production. And it even developed a relationship between changes that were happening in industrial practices with changes that were happening in terms of labor regulations and companies having to compensate for the decrease in revenue that they were incurring as a result of having to put into place better labor standards, with changes that they were making at the level of the substances they were using in their production practices. I'm wondering if you have anything to say about the relationship between the development of capitalism and the development of cancer.
I think there's an absolutely clear relationship as a result of the nature of capitalist production. Who makes the decisions in a capitalist society? The people who seek to make profit, the employers. They make all of the decisions with respect to the productive process, whether a factory or a mine or a processing facility will exist or not, what substances will be used in production, what substances will be produced in production, how they're going to be used, what the nature of the process. All of those decisions are made by people who are the capitalist class. Then the people who are exposed to those substances, whether they're using them in the productive process or they're being produced through the productive process, are workers. And that's a real tragedy of all of this. Workers are the guinea pigs in the capitalist system for testing these various substances and discovering the results, the cancers, in their bodies. If you look at the literature, most of what we know today that in terms of known carcinogens have been discovered as a result of workers becoming ill in groups as a result of their workplace exposures. And why? Well, of course, those are the areas in which the carcinogens, these cancer-causing substances, are most concentrated. The highest exposures are in workplaces. So we're going to find out first about whether a particular substance or combination of substances gives you cancer in the workplace. Now, there obviously are a few situations, such as smoking, in which people are exposed outside of the workplace. But certainly most of our knowledge, in fact, has come as a result of workers being the guinea pigs.
I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about mainstream medical explanations for the epidemic and maybe explain a little bit about what accounts for this discrepancy between a popular understanding of cancer causation, mostly a sort of sense that it's either genetic or to do with lifestyle choice, and the research that you're doing that shows it to be something that we can talk about in terms of elevated risk according to, for example, one's labor or probably one's wealth. Why aren't we seeing similar kinds of research coming out, for example, of the cancer establishment?
Well, I think that the cancer establishment, you know, in Canada, in the United States, and in Europe, but certainly most clearly in the United States and Canada, has exhibited an enormous social class bias. I guess that's putting it in its most, you know, if you will, scientific terms. In other words, they haven't looked at the issue of cancer from the point of view of people in their workplace, of poor people, of the barriers that exist to trying to have a healthy and decent life. And because, in part, examining this puts them on a potential collision course with the large companies, the large petrochemical industry, you know, the manufacturers, the mining industry, the transportation industry, the pesticide producers, who have hired large numbers of scientists and toxicologists and epidemiologists and physicians to protect their interest, which is their interest to make money. And if the cancer establishment confronts those interests, then there's all kinds of hell to be paid. Now, I mean, it's revealing if you take a look at, you know, kind of the general history of how, you know, we've come, the cancer establishment now really downplays the role of work as a contributor to cancer. It, by and large, you know, if it's pressed and it is assigned some value, you know, to how much cancer is work-related, they, in Ontario as an example, their latest numbers, they say maybe 4 or 5% of cancer is work-related. If you translate that to the actual population that they're talking about, which is primarily blue-collar workers, a 4 or 5% attributable risk to the overall population among the exposed population would translate to almost 25% of cancer among blue-collar workers is work-related. So even the very low estimates of work-related cancer still represent an enormous cancer burden among the exposed population. And yet if you look at what if you go to their websites or if you look at their literature, you find that work is almost completely and totally absent as any kind of strategy for cancer prevention. And so it does come to mind, well, why is that? And why is it that none of them, no portion of the cancer establishment, has really put any resources or any emphasis into documenting the work-related histories of cancer patients? Because given the important role that industrial workers and the working population played in identifying carcinogens throughout the 20th century, you'd think it would really be in everybody's interest to do that, because with all these new substances we have, how do we know that there's whole groups of people that we never even considered that might be sitting out there with a cancer risk? For instance, women who work on farms. So, in my view, it's because the cancer establishment is part of the overall intellectual group in society that instinctively is preserving and supporting the current powers that be. It's not prepared to take on the major multinationals that produce these substances. It's not prepared to align itself with the populations at risk, like workers in these industries. It feels safer and better if the focus of cancer scientific investigations, you know, or in scientific investigations into cancer or for medical practice, to focus completely at the level of treatment. And because of that, you know, cancer continues to increase. They're now saying, you know, by 2020, the year 2020, they expect the incidence of cancer to double. And the impact of this on society is is going to be enormous, not to mention what it means to an individual who actually gets diagnosed with this disease. You know, health doesn't exist separately from all the other issues that we face in society. The dominant groups in society, the groups that have the most power and the most say about what goes on, have a very strong interest in preserving their power and their economic well-being. And most of that appears in our society in the form of large multinational corporations that are the primary producers of synthetic chemicals and of mining and resources and manufacturing and so on. And the scientific community, which doesn't exist independent of all that, is very much connected, and it's connected very concretely through, you know, who gives money for this research, who defines it, who says, you know, what are the priorities, whose health is important, and so on, and the focus of it. And so I think that the fact that blue-collar cancer, or cancer among blue-collar workers and among women, breast cancer as an example, is primarily, I mean, being, you know, defined in ways that generally, either in the case of blue-collar workers, they usually blame them for what they take to be their poor lifestyle choices, like smoking, even though that many of these cancers are not smoking-related, that these workers seem to have in abundance, or women where, you know, by and large, even though we don't understand the majority of the cases that occur, it's generally associated with lifestyle choices. How many children did they have? When did they start menstruating? Did they use, you know, hormonal replacement therapy? And so on. And so there's this notion of almost blaming the victim rather than the scientific community looking at the objectively, if you will, at, you know, the possibilities from cancer and looking at all things in an equal way, if you will. For instance, looking at the impact of occupation, really taking this thing on, and if we find that exposures in certain industries are triggering these diseases, then being prepared to advocate on the behalf of the populations at risk.
Well, I think, unfortunately, in the mainstream, the cancer epidemic is put forward as being as a consequence of people's lifestyle. Certainly issues like smoking are factors. Our bad diet is certainly a factor. But even in diet and smoking, we have to recognize that there is a concerted corporate effort to promote carcinogens. The tobacco lobby is enormous, wealthy, completely unprincipled, and continues to try to hook people on cigarette smoking. Why? Because they're in business to make money, and they make enormous profits out of tobacco sales. Same with food additives. These are big lobbies by chemical companies who invent these things. How many of them are carcinogens? Well, you know, oftentimes we don't know very much about these things before we start adding them to our foods, and we certainly don't know much about combinations. And when you look at the enormous amount of processing of our foodstuffs today, this is big business. You know, the Westons of the world make enormous amounts of money as a result of selling food products. And the more processed they are, the more money these companies stand to make. It's not in their interest to promote small-scale or organic production, which would be certainly much less of an issue with respect to the possibilities of carcinogens. And look at pesticides in food production. You know, again, enormously wealthy chemical companies actively promote the spreading of these carcinogens on our food products. Why? So that they can make enormous profits. So I think that you can see here that even for the conventional wisdom that cancer is as a result of lifestyle issues, there's no question that the capitalist marketplace seriously affects people's health in a terrible way. But I think the other aspect that is part of the conventional wisdom about cancer, that it's lifestyle related, and no recognition of the other factors I think, is something that we have to challenge.
Well, what are the political implications in terms of meaningful cancer prevention of portraying this epidemic as a matter of lifestyle?
Well, I think that then you have the cancer establishment, the Canadian Cancer Society, and the cancer researchers not focusing on prevention, because that would challenge the corporate agenda. That would challenge the way business says it's our sole right what we produce and how we produce it. And, you know, if the cancer establishment were to challenge that, then an awful lot of money that is raised either by business or through business for cancer treatment, for the so-called cancer cure, then you would see these corporations not be so willing to fork out if the Canadian Cancer Society and other members of the cancer establishment said, I'm sorry, you guys are responsible for this epidemic. You're not going to get them contributing the way they do now. And I think the other major player in all of this, of course, is the pharmaceutical industry. And, I mean, it's a bit ghoulish to say, but if people weren't sick, they wouldn't be able to produce these anti-neoplastic drugs, and they wouldn't be making an enormous profit as a result of the production of these chemicals that are designed to treat cancer, which, by the way, are often carcinogens themselves. You know, when you're designing a drug to kill a tumor, it often decides that it's going to take off and kill some other healthy cells as well, and they can create the cancers in other organs and other parts of the body.
And how are campaigns to prevent occupational diseases, campaigns which advocate, for example, the legislating of safer industry practices, being undermined or obstructed by international trade agreements such as NAFTA and the FTAA?
Well, I think certainly that NAFTA has shown that domestic regulation can be challenged by foreign corporations successfully. The example, for example, of the ban on MMT, that was a good initiative by the federal government, but as soon as the Ethyl Corporation in the United States went after the federal government under NAFTA, the government backed right off and, in fact, paid Ethyl $19 million for their effort and never enforced this law at all. I mean, it's completely ironic because MMT, as an additive for fuel, is banned in the United States. And here's a U.S. corporation who can challenge a Canadian law and get our federal government to completely back off. It's really quite appalling, but that's what they're allowed to do under NAFTA. Asbestos is a very important issue for us. We have had in the brake manufacturing industry a number of fatalities as a result of the lung cancers and the mesotheliomas that have been contracted by our members. As well, we have an insulation and foundry complex in Sarnia where we know more than 100 of our members have died from occupational disease as a result of their work in producing engines and insulation products for the automotive industry and for other industry as well. Those workers have passed away in large numbers, and some of their family members have been affected as well as a result of the asbestos that the workers brought home on their clothing, and their wives were exposed to it when they washed their clothes. The children were exposed when they came home and hugged their dad. And, you know, I know at least one of our members' sons contracted mesothelioma. He was 14 years old, and he died at 16, 2 years later. A very horrible disease and a horrible death.
Well, Kathy, I'm glad you brought up asbestos, because I wanted to ask you how cancer rates and workplace exposure globally is affected by economic globalization and the internationalization of trade. I know, for example, in the case of asbestos, that there seems to have been some success locally in that there's finally a recognition that the substance is toxic, not safe for Canadian workers or citizens. And yet the asbestos industry and the Canadian government are just shifting production into the export of asbestos and the selling of asbestos overseas to mostly poorer countries that probably have even less occupational health and safety regulations. Is this an issue that the labor movement here in Canada is dealing with?
Yeah, I think it's really appalling what's going on in Canada right now. We've largely banned its use in practice. We don't use asbestos in brakes anymore. We don't use asbestos in insulation, in all kinds of household products that we used to use it. It's been substituted with safer substances. So effectively, it's not used in Canada anymore. I think it's unconscionable for us to mine asbestos and ship it to developing countries in which there is little or absolutely no protection. You know, we've talked to people, we've seen people in developing countries work with asbestos, and this stuff comes in bags, raw from Quebec, and people are breaking this stuff open with sledgehammers, mixing it up by hand, throwing it by hand onto conveyors, mixing it up into asbestos cement, where they're literally covered in asbestos. And lots of people have already died from these exposures, and lots more will die. And I think it's really appalling that the federal government and the Quebec provincial government have been promoting this, particularly when you look at the legacy of death in Quebec. The 1949 asbestos strike was such a heroic battle for the Quebec workers. It really led to the Quiet Revolution in Quebec. It was such a militant struggle, and they were fighting to try and save their own lives. The mines were cleaned up a bit as a result of that strike, no question about it, but the workers battled again in the 70s to try and get the mines cleaned up. And those were, again, heroic struggles by the workers in Thetford Mines and in asbestos. And I think it's really shameful today that we can consider, while we've been able to clean up the mines substantially, that we can consider taking this product and shipping it off to developing countries where so many people, workers and family members, will die. You know, I've seen in Nicaragua, for example, and I know this is true in many, many other developing countries, these very small, you know, not much more than huts that people live in with corrugated asbestos roofing tile. Eventually, this asbestos cement roofing tiles will deteriorate, and you'll see asbestos fibers dropping onto children, into the kitchen, onto the beds, and everybody in the home will be contaminated.
I did want to ask you, Jim, how the community members of Sarnia have reacted to evidence that their high rates of cancer are related to occupational exposures. Is there a sense among people that they've been deceived or betrayed, or who do they hold responsible for this?
Well, I think in the community there's a mixed reaction among the people that have the diseases and among their family members, because a lot of what came out about, you know, this real cluster of a particularly asbestos-related disease here came out because of widows and women in the community. Among that group, you know, there's a sense of relief that finally people are talking about this. When we first came in, I remember talking with a woman whose father had died when she was 17 from lung cancer. He had been a welder here, and he believed, and she always believed, that his cancer was work-related, and we finally did establish that about 20 years after his death with the compensation board. She was very affected by all of this, and she said to me, you know, we accepted here that our men died young, but we're not prepared to accept it anymore. And that was something that always stayed with me, that there had been, you know, an acceptance of this. But in the community now, more and more people are not prepared to accept this. They're not prepared to accept diseases that could be prevented if there was the will to do so. So among that section, which is primarily, you know, women whose husbands have died of these diseases and certain, you know, important section of the blue-collar workers, the skilled tradespeople, the petrochemical workers, there's a sense of relief that finally this issue is being talked about. Among the more middle-class section, and even among some workers, there's a real fear, first of all, that the petrochemical plants will close, and there's because this industry has been downsizing for the last decade or two, and there's a heck of a lot less, you know, employment here there in among these industries than there once was, and so there's a fear that, you know, if they get bad publicity, they'll just close the facility and move, and you know, workers, you know, are trying to protect their standard of living. It's not easy in the global economy, and they don't take kindly to all of this publicity on this issue. And these people, by and large, are the ones that are not sick now or may not have shared those same exposures and also are hoping that they won't be the ones that get these illnesses. The middle class is divided as well. There's a section of the middle class that's very concerned about the environment, not just the occupational part, but, you know, what's being released and leaving these plants and going over the community as a whole and what effect this might have on, you know, their children, on themselves. Will it increase their risk of cancer? You know, are they more likely to have respiratory disease? You know, is there learning disabilities and all kinds of other things associated with these exposures? Could it be affecting them? Another portion of the middle class, which is probably the largest section of the middle class, is very afraid of all of this because they think it's bad publicity, that it harms property values, and it makes them vulnerable that, you know, their major investments like their homes and their lives, you know, are going to be cheapened by the media examining these issues. And so all of this, I wish it was in a way we were all saying, look, you know, something happened here. We're going to deal with this. We're going to take major steps. We're going to face this issue. And everybody in the community agreed to that. But the truth of the matter is that all this focusing on occupational health and cancer, on environmental health and issues arising from, you know, the plant exposures has not been universally applauded or accepted by the community. And my guess is that that's true, you know, in lots of communities. I'm sure it's true in Thetford Mines and Asbestos Quebec in the asbestos industry. I'm sure it would have been true in Elliott Lake and the uranium mining in Ontario in the 70s and 80s and in Sudbury at the nickel plants or at Stelco and DeFasco with the steel industry in Hamilton. All of these industrial communities and these communities relying on these major industries have, you know, a divided loyalty, a divided sense of how we should face these problems.
I wanted to ask you, in your opinion, if cancer as an epidemic is preventable, can we wage and win a war against cancer, and what does that mean to you?
I think it's generally accepted, you know, certainly in most of the literature, that, you know, 70 to 90% of all cancer is completely preventable. Yet, you know, we're faced with an epidemic that, you know, within the next decade is expected to be the number one killer in our society. So how is this preventable disease being allowed to get literally out of control? And I think it's a very important question. And I think people, you know, that face this disease recognize its horror and, you know, really have a stake in trying to prevent it. But why this is occurring, I think, is something that we need to understand more and more deeply, because I think cancer prevention should be a major public health goal. But there are enormous barriers to this, not just directly from employers and multinational corporations that have a real stake in maintaining, you know, the status quo, but also from the cancer establishment and from the scientific and medical community that have a major vested interest and a major perception that, you know, cancer should be essentially treated and improved diagnosis rather than tackling the really serious issue of prevention. And I hope that as this research continues to increase as unions and women's health groups and industrial communities like Sarnia begin to become more aware and more organized, that there will be increasing pressure to finally deal with this issue of cancer, because if we don't face it, then we have a pretty serious future ahead of us.
I think it certainly is something that we can wage and win. It will not be an easy issue to take on because, of course, cancer isn't just one disease. It's a home in a variety of organs throughout our bodies, and as a result, we need to wage the war on any number of fronts. We certainly need to identify what we know right now and deal with it. And we need to challenge the corporate agenda, which says they can invent any new chemical or substance or process and bring it into our society with almost no regulation whatsoever. We need to say, no, you can't do that. You have to ensure, and the government has to ensure that they have done sufficient testing before these new things are invented and introduced into our workplace and into our environment, into our food and into our air. We can do this if we choose to do it. We can pass laws that regulate corporate behavior, and we can take initiative in our workplace and in our communities to ensure that these changes take place. It's not an easy fight, but it is one we can all take on, and we can win.
Kathy Walker is the National Health and Safety Director of the Canadian Auto Workers Union, which has since 1997 been active in a cancer prevention campaign. Dr. Jim Brophy is the Executive Director of the Occupational Health Clinic for Ontario Workers in Sarnia. You have been listening to The Growth Principle, a radio documentary exploring the relationship between cancer, capitalism, and class in the industrialized West. The Growth Principle was produced by Brett Story at CKUT Radio in Montreal.